Accession number 9437, reel 12.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 12. Could I now ask you about leaving Yenan, Elizabeth? You know, was any sort of send-off? Did you get a present or send-off from the communists?
Oh, yes, we did. In Yenan, we got some beautiful wolfskin gown linings and also, I think, some embroidery that I've forgotten to bring home. But before we'd left the hospital in Shanxi, before we travelled to Yenan, the hospital staff had gone to enormous trouble to make a wonderful banner for us, which was to commemorate foreign friends' help to the communists in the border regions. They had somebody had been sent to a local market to buy a large piece of red satin, and then they'd cut the Chinese letters out in white cloth from a sheet, I believe, and embroidered them on very beautifully and had a gold fringe along the bottom. And it was presented to us at a big meeting when the hospital manager had said what wonderful work we'd done, and we felt highly embarrassed and not worthy of this splendid tribute they'd given us, which, because we were in such a primitive area, it really was a wonderful thing that they'd been able to... they'd taken great trouble to give this to us, which made the gift very, very much more precious. And I hope we earned the sentiments they expressed. This banner now has been returned to Yenan by Margaret Stanley. I think it should be in the museum there. Anyway, they gave us these presents of these wolf skins. We had ours, or perhaps they were fox skins. Anyway, I had mine made up into bed covers when I got home. They were lovely. It lasted for years and years and years.
Were you due for repatriation?
We were overdue for repatriation, yes.
Yes. How long had you agreed to go to China?
I think we'd agreed to go for 2 years, and this must have been... we were away over three years, I think, yes. And, you know, with the end of the war and everything, Eric felt he must get back to work. And, anyway, we had to wait quite a long time because of... this was the rainy season, and the roads were not suitable. We were going part of the way by truck, and we were kept waiting a long time in Yunnan. I don't remember this at all, but I know from the dates it must have been so. There was a bomb dropped in Yunnan while we were staying there in July. I can't think how that can have happened, but we were in Yunnan from the 18th of July until the 12th of August. And
1940.
This is 1948. And we kept running out of petrol and so on. And then the roads would be very dangerous. If there was a nasty corner, we'd all get out of the truck and the truck would go round the corner and with a great precipice down one side, and we'd all walk round and then get back into the truck. And at one point there was a terrible bridge, and Doug Clifford took one look at it and he thought he'd better drive over, not let the Chinese driver drive over it. And he pulled all the telegraph wires down doing it. But then what the Chinese would have done, I dread to think. So in some ways it was quite a hair-raising drive. But then the cliffs would have fallen down and you'd have to wait till you got some villagers to come and clear it all away before we could go past. At one point, we had to travel by train, and we would travel in open trucks overnight. We all piled in with our luggage, and it reminded me of scenes in The Small Woman, you know. It wasn't quite so bad, because we hadn't got the enemy on our tail. And we also had to travel by mule cart, and then the worst transport in the world, ox carts. They go slower than walking, and very, very slow indeed. And I know at one point I was sat in the ox cart holding David, and Eric took the nappies, walked down to a local stream, washed the nappies and caught us up without having to run. No springs at all. It was absolutely really dreadful. And then we did travel in a proper train at some point on the 29th of August and arrived in Sichuan, which is quite a sizable town. And although we'd heard that... Hoskins and Miles and Henry Yu, a group of FSU from Shanghai, had set off for Sichuan a long time before, they only just arrived the same time we did. which was very nice. And after that, Doug Clifford left us and went with the FSU party. And we met up with an American called Perry Hansen, who worked for UNICEF, who had a weapons carrier, who was going to Tientsin. And so we went with him. We started off again quite soon after that. The roads were very muddy. It wasn't hilly anymore. It was mostly flat country. But the roads were terrible, and the truck would sink down to its axles in mud every now and then. And fortunately, they have winches on them, and you'd fix the winch to the nearest tree, and it would pull us out. And I found I could walk. I used to have to get out of the weapons carrier carrying David, and the best thing to do was to take your shoes off, and you could keep upright better in the mud without shoes on. And the poor interpreter, can't remember which interpreter it was nearly in tears, saying this foreign lady having to stand there with, in the mud with no shoes on. So that was quite an experience too. But we did meet one or two places where there were foreigners still living. They said they had to be pretty circumspect with the communist soldiers coming in, because the communists had only taken over very recently, and there were lots of them that were not under any proper discipline. If they came in and wandered round the house, you let them, and there was no trouble.
Would they have been missionaries?
They were missionaries, yes, mostly. I see that we met a nurse and an evangelist on the 22nd of August. And later, I can remember, we stayed... when we were with Perry, we stayed with a small mission group that said that they'd... they were managing to carry on fairly well, although their food was very simple. But there wasn't any real friction with the authorities. By September the 4th, we were very near the border between nationalist and communist territories, only a short way south of Tientsin. And actually, although there was rumours that the Kuomintang were in a certain town, we found out later it was only bandits. And really, we crossed the border with really no problems whatsoever. I think somebody had gone ahead and got some passes for us, and the interpreters disappeared. And I think we had some sort of escort with us. And we crossed over to a town south of Tientsin, where we got on a railway that took us into Tientsin. And it was really as if nothing had happened. Of course, Tientsin was another thing altogether, because here was a westernised city which had recently become quite affluent, with an enormous influx of relief personnel and other people coming back to China and trying to get business things sorted out, because obviously the communists were going to take over soon, a great number of people. I remember the new look had come in, while we'd been off in the hinterland, and there I was with a baby flung over my shoulder, my hair, not been to a hairdresser for years, hanging down over my shoulders, my skirt up to my knees, and there were all these UNRWA females, beautifully coiffed and dressed in their skirts down, nearly down to their ankles, looking down their nose at me, you know. It was, I felt... I didn't really care, you know, it was quite amusing. I thought, well, they haven't done what I've done. We also went to the consulate there and got David registered. And Eric had a private talk with the consul there and said, you know, please don't pass any of this I've told you on until you get the go-ahead from FSU headquarters and so on.
I was going to ask, were you able to reveal where you'd been?
Well, that was the proviso Eric made, and whether anything was ever made of that or not, again, I don't know. We had various people called on us when we got to Peking a little bit later, and we didn't say an awful lot at that point. We felt we'd wait until we'd been back to headquarters in Shanghai and discussed it with the FSU people.
Was that a wise decision, do you think?
I think it may have been, especially as there are quite a lot of Chinese members in the unit. Certainly after we'd left and the communists had taken over, the FSU found their position quite difficult, and that people who knew them tended to get less good treatment than people who didn't know foreigners. I think I'd mentioned that when we'd been travelling, the nearer we got to Shanghai, and the east coast, the less well treated we were, much to the disgust of our interpreters. But I mean, it was quite understandable in a way. Anyway, we stayed in Tientsin a few days, and then Perry was going on to Peking, so we decided we'd go to Peking with him. There was some problems about getting money. There was this terrible inflation, and we kept sending telegrams asking for money. And I think Eric thought we'd probably have a better chance of getting money through to Peking than we would to Tientsin. Anyway, we went to Peking, and we were very fortunate. We were able to go and see quite a lot of the sights, and although carrying a nine-month-old baby is not the ideal way to see the Forbidden City.
Where did you stay in Peking?
Well, we stayed the first few nights in the Peking Hotel.
Oh, is that that big one right
yes,
in the centre?
Yes. And when it was strange, when we went back, when we were invited by the Ministry of Health, we stayed in the Peking Hotel, and I thought, this isn't where we came. And then I realised, in the latter part of our stay, that we were in the new wing, and I went sort of wandering around, exploring, and I found the staircase where we'd gone in, right the other side of where the old hotel had been.
Yes, it's been built in three stages,
I suppose
it?
So,
three
yes,
styles.
Yes, yes. And so we really were in the Peking Hotel for, I think, only two nights. And then I can't remember who we stayed with, and then we stayed with an FAU member.
What was the state of Peking then? Because after all, the Japanese would have held it, wouldn't they?
Yes.
And then the nationalists would have obviously
yes.
taken control. Was it very run down?
Not terrible. Well, you see, it's rather difficult for me to judge because of having been away in the wild so long. Certainly, my recollection is that the actual Forbidden City was more run down then than it was when we came back when it was under the communists. On the other hand, I think the roof tiles were perhaps in better state, but that may be, you know, it's difficult to remember, but the photographs show that there are weeds growing up between the pavements back in when we were there in the 40s.
In the Forbidden City?
In the Forbidden City. But the roofs, I remember, is much more shining and complete than they were later. But that may have been a trick of the sun or something. The shops seemed to be absolutely bursting. But then I hadn't seen a shop for ages, you see. So, I mean, a couple of iced buns looked absolutely magnificent to me. Yes. Actually, of course, Peking was very full of people because the communists were advancing at quite a speed and a lot of people were afraid of the communists and crowding into the big cities that would obviously be the last places to fall. And we went to the Temple of Heaven, and that was being used as a hostel for displaced students. And they were all lying out on the floor in the Temple of Heaven.
In the various halls there, weren't they?
I only remember them in the main Temple of Heaven, you know, the blue roofed building. And I remember we were able to wander around there a lot, and though we didn't go to the Whispering Wall. I dare say that wasn't open then. But I remember us walking around quite a long way there. There was a Chinese member, Julie Chu, who was a student in Peking, and she took us around a lot. And I know Eric was longing to go to the Great Wall. Well, I was too, but I couldn't go with David. And she and David and Eric and Julie Chu went down to the station on more than one occasion and waited ages and ages for a train that was promised, and it never came because there was military activity up near the wall. So we had to wait 25 years before we saw the wall.
Of course, you wouldn't have seen it on your travels, would
no,
you?
No, we kept hoping we'd walk as far as the Great Wall, but we never really got nearer than 100 miles or so from it.
So from Peking, did you go to Shanghai on your
yes,
way
home?
Yes,
we did. We eventually money came through and we must have bought the air tickets. And I know we were allocated a plane one day and we went out to the airport. And I think we'd even got on the plane, but then we were made to get off again because Chiang Kai-shek was flying off from the other side of the airport. We actually saw him boarding a plane.
Is that when he was going to Taiwan, do you think?
I don't think it was quite as early as that. But anyway, the airport had to be cleared for him to get out. I don't think we even got out that day. I think we must have gone the next day.
What was the atmosphere like? You know, this is quite late in 1948.
Yes, it was a bit tense. I mean, everyone felt the end was inevitable, that the communists would move in the foreseeable future. and people were making contingency plans. There wasn't an awful sense of urgency, but there was a sense that something ought to be done because, you know, things were not going to stay the same. In the shops, people were very reluctant to sell you anything because, of course, the Chinese dollar was worth practically nothing, and people would rather have goods than any type of money. American dollars, I think they would have accepted, probably, but we didn't have dollars. I didn't have dollars. So you'd go in to buy... I went to try and get some knitting wool or some knitting yarn or something, and, oh, no, there wasn't enough to make what I wanted to make. You know, they wouldn't sell it. And I should like to have got some more china, and I had great difficulty. I managed to buy eight soup bowls, I think, but every time I went to buy anything, there was some reason why they couldn't sell it me. So I wasn't able to bring very much home. I got some embroidery.
In the villages you'd visited in Yan'an, did they have any lovely pottery there or sort of craft work that you...
No. For most of our time there, we never saw a shop. In some of the villages, a peddler came, I think, on about two occasions in a year. There were no actual shops. Once or twice on our travels, we went through a slightly larger town where there were actually some shops and also some street vendors selling sweet cakes, that sort of thing. But on the whole, we never saw anything that was just for ordinary for sale, like in a shop. And in Yan'an, there were very, very few shops, but not at that time any craft work at all.
Right, so how did you get home to England then? Did you have to go...
Well, we went to Shanghai, mm-hmm. and then Eric went on a trip with somebody up to Zhongwu, where there was a project rehabilitating a village that had been flooded by when the course of the Yellow River had been changed. So we were in Shanghai for some time, and we got a boat at the beginning of November, a horrible French liner, and we were travelling second class, which was certainly vastly inferior to the first class, but there was at least a fourth class, so we weren't as bad as all that. We had this comparatively uncomfortable journey to Marseille, and there were all nationalities on board. Then we went by train up to Paris, and while we were in Paris, we had a telegram from London saying, "Come home, the BBC wants you to appear on television." So we came home in time for this... television. Neither Eric nor... Well, I certainly hadn't seen television. I don't know whether Eric had. Before we actually appeared on it at Alexandra Palace with Leslie Mitchell interviewed us with some of Doug's... I think they were Doug's photos, blown up so big that you couldn't even see them looking at them. So how they must have appeared on the television, I don't know. But that was quite exciting.
Would the FAU have been responsible for this?
Yes, they were. Yes. Can't think of his name. The... public relations officer in London had arranged it all.
What sort of impact did it make, you know, the fact that you had returned from Yan'an and had been with communists? Because we're talking about late 1948, when the Cold War was underway.
Yes, you know, they weren't terribly enthusiastic about when they heard that we'd been with communists, you know. They thought we must be pretty peculiar people.
Did you find that when people spoke to you or asked you questions, that they were looking at it negatively, communism, Chinese communism?
It was rather a different attitude than the attitude you'd find today, I feel.
In what way?
Well, as you say, they were prejudiced against communism, and of course there was prejudice against pacifists too, I think. Because, I mean, so many people had suffered so much in the war, and we seemed to have taken a soft option. Yes, that's what I felt.
Yes, I must ask you more about, you know, the pacifist side of this in a moment, Elizabeth. But while we're talking about the publicity, you know, did you have attention from the press?
Well, yes, they all the papers, a lot of journalists were waiting for us at Victoria. And we went to the hotel there for tea, and I can't remember who, there were a lot of relations and a lot of FAU and a lot of journalists. All came talking to us. And then we went to my mother's in Croydon, and a journalist called on us there. And the next morning, all the papers except the serious ones had features about us.
What was the line they were taking? What were the things they were highlighting?
Oh, we were back from China. Every single one of them was madly inaccurate. Really, very poor. Very, very poor journalism. When I was looking through those cuttings, you know, when I got them out to show you, the only ones, the most accurate one, was from the High Wycombe local paper, which my in-laws must have given them information. And the next best was the Croydon local paper. But all the main papers, it was just absolute rubbish they put in.
What were they sort of fastening on to? What aspects of it?
Well, that David had been born in a cave. It was the baby. It was the baby, you see, that you can imagine, the picture papers, the baby born in a cave. One of them had a photo of me the day after he was born, and one of them had me... my sister-in-law was talking about how furious she was. They'd said he's still a first-class baby or something, and there we were in a first-class, looking out of a first-class carriage, which they'd plonked us in, you see, which was ridiculous.
Yes, it doesn't quite give the tone of
the
whole office.
And hardly any of them got the name of the organisation right. They called it all sorts of peculiar things. Hardly, don't think anyone said the Friends Ambulance Unit or the Friends Service Unit. It was really dreadful. If you look at those cuttings, I think you've got some you'll find. Absolute, it's all wrong.
Were the BBC more accurate, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, they were a bit more careful. Yes, because we did an interview on In Town Tonight. And we did another one for overseas, the overseas broadcasts, as well as this television programme. And I did get a talk on for Woman's Hour. I think that was all. But the stuff in the newspapers was a right terrible mess.
When you heard about the news of the communist victory in October 1949... Were you surprised? You
know? Oh, I wasn't surprised at all. No, no. It had seemed quite inevitable, particularly when we were on the way home. There were a lot of Chinese students on board, and they were saying that Chiang Kai-shek had called the silver in as well as the gold, and anyone who'd had any money had lost everything. And, you know, there was nothing more to be taken from them. And they felt that everyone would turn against Chiang Kai-shek then, and that the end really had come. And, of course, it came very soon.
Yet when one considers the strength of the Kuomintang, you know, after the war, regarding numbers of troops, you know, the support they had numerically and the way they were equipped by their foreign services, I wonder, you know, did you see any reason why the communists had achieved victory over them?
Well, I think the Kuomintang army was a conscripted army, and but the communist army, the communists were seen to be helping the people. And and they were free people, and the numbers of Chinese is absolutely enormous, and it's very easy to sway the views of conscripted soldiers, and I think the people had been repressed so much they were only too willing to welcome a regime that was much more fair to them, and I think I'd felt for a long time that the takeover of the communists was absolutely inevitable.
Do you think the Japanese were a factor as well as the sort of ineptness of the Kuomintang?
I don't. I find it difficult to assess the effect of the Japanese. They had done so much damage, and they treated the Chinese so harshly over such a long period. After all, the war had started back in the 30s. That the Chinese, I expect they felt that the communists would offer them a steady Chinese government, and they'd welcome something that was really Chinese after being governed by foreigners, dominated by foreigners for so long.
You mentioned earlier that you were invited back. You know, does this it really indicates that the communists were grateful for the work that you did?
Well, I think so. I mean, it must have done. They couldn't have. They were not under any pressure to invite us. Margaret Stanley wrote asking if she could take a party in, with no idea of it being at anyone else's expense. And she was quite amazed when she got this invitation to collect a party to be hosted by the Ministry of Health, the government and the Ministry of Health.
What date was that?
This was...
1978.
This was really wonderful.
This would have been after the Cultural Revolution.
Cultural Revolution was over by then. Well, and really buried. And Mao's dead. We saw his mausoleum in the square. What's it called?
Tiananmen
Square. This was really wonderful. We were treated as honoured guests everywhere. They kept asking us where we would like to go, and we consequently were able to get off the main tourist track sometimes, which was wonderful. Some places we wanted to go, because for the reason of collecting the people, we had to be there in August. We wanted to go down the gorges on the Yangtze, but they said it really was too hot, even for Chinese, let alone foreigners. But they would have let us if it hadn't been that it had to be in August. But what was really, for me, the highlight was we had a big party in the Peking Hotel where they collected together anyone who had had anything to do with the FAU, and that really was marvellous. Dr. Li Bing, who I've mentioned, was there, of course, and Dr. Zhou, the other Dr. Su, I think, had died. He was one who'd been in the hospital in Yunnan, and also Dr. Jin, who was the surgeon. But there were many other people, and people connected with the project at Zhengmu, of which I had no personal knowledge. And there were a great crowd of people who knew us, and Margaret Stanley was able to show a film strip of that she had shown in America about China then and now. And that was a really wonderful experience. And we had the album of photographs you've got a copy of, which we were able to show them, which was very splendid. They kept recognising themselves at other times. Not that everyone was involved, because they'd got lots of people from other projects and not to do with anything to do with MT19.
So it would seem that they really appreciated what you did in the years 46 to 48.
It really did seem as if that we must have made more impact than we had felt we had. It was wonderful. Also, it was fine to find that they'd followed up things like the Kala Azar eradication program that the FAU had started, and they had eradicated Kala Azar in certain areas where he'd been hoping to do that. And it was really a wonderful trip.